listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Thank you so much for inviting us here. We're thrilled to have such a group of scholars and policy officials that we can share our research with. And this is from a World Bank document, actually, that just came out on the increased labor force participation of women in Latin America. So we thought that that picture, we took it from there, and we thought the picture was sort of evocative of our topic, which is sort of the combination of paid work and unpaid care work. And our actual title is Catching Up with the Quiet Revolution, Work-Family Policies in Latin America. And just as a quick comment, this is a work in progress, so we actually would love to have feedback from you guys in the question and answer session. So we'll start off with some slides giving you the context, and then we'll get to the heart of what our actual empirical analysis is about. And so briefly, the context in Latin America, what we see is over the past decade or two decades, increasing and stratified participation of women in the labor force. And here you can see from 1990 to 2010, the general trend is very much to increase. Over half the region's female population is now economically active. And where you also see a big difference is that it's stratified by quintile. As many of you probably know, Latin America is the most unequal region in the world socioeconomically, and you can see that in the activation of women from different income quintiles. It's quite a bit lower for women in the lowest income quintiles and much higher for women in the highest income quintiles, and that, of course, reinforces socioeconomic inequalities between families. We don't have the data here, but also in terms of the topic of work and family, what's interesting is that that average of 52%, when you disaggregate it by age, there's a big difference too. Women of childbearing age, the labor force participation rates for them now are 70% for the region. So you can really see a generational difference. So the trend is likely to dramatically increase.
So the problem is that women have entered labor markets that are really poorly regulated, right? So even if you look at data for 2010, after a very positive decade of formalization of the labor force in Latin America, you can still see that about 40% of the salaried population does not and will not have a pension or any other type of social protection. And if you move from salaried workers to occupied workers, where most women are, because these involve the self-employed, then the gap between women and men increases, and almost 60% of all women in the region lack social protection. So on the one hand, you have this increased labor participation. On the other hand, it's leading women into poorly regulated labor markets. At the same time that we see all this change in the labor market, we see an important change in the composition of families, so much so that there you see how the male breadwinner family, like the very first bar, is not the most prevailing type of family in the region anymore, but the dual earner family is, followed by extended families, and then by nuclear families headed by women. So these are families, types of families, that were not the kind of family social policies we're thinking about before when they were established. Just to follow a little bit on the role of households or families with female head of households, there you can see for all countries in Latin America, the change between 1990 and mid-2000s, in all countries, you see an increase in the relevance of urban households headed by women, regardless of how that's operationalized, which is a complicated matter. And so this new or increasing type of household seems to be here to stay in the region. So change in the labor market, changes in family composition, and yet, as documented by the 2009 ILO and UNDP report, inertia in what households and families do with unpaid work. So there you can see men without children, with children, women without children, with children, you can see that for men, the amount of weekly hours devoted to unpaid work basically increases a little bit or remains the same or even decreases, like in Nicaragua. But the opposite happens with women, among which it's a very consistent pattern that the presence of young children will increase the amount of unpaid work women devote to look after their families.
And one of my favorite statistics is from Brazil, where time use studies show that for mothers with two young children, if they have a husband in the household, the time that they have to dedicate to household and care work goes up. And so they're better off. The female-headed households, the time that they devote to that is less than when a husband is actually in the house versus
right.
when they're
like,
there.
But since we're looking for allies, we don't usually say it, right?
Oops, you just jumped. Okay. So in short, this data is also reflective of the fact that now there's much more attention to these phenomenons, and international organizations are gathering a lot of data on these very issues. And over the last 2 years, many international organizations, the ILO, the UNDP, ECLAC, the World Bank, they've all published documents pointing to exactly these kinds of issues and saying that this is one of the most pressing public policy concerns in the region today. And so there's a growing consensus that the work-family nexus is a key public policy concern. However, to date, there's been little analysis of what exactly is going on politically around this issue. So sort of an empirical analysis of how have governments responded to these socioeconomic challenges. And that's what our research project looks to do. Okay, and so there's three prongs to our project. And the first one is to chart changes. How have governments responded, and with what implications for co-responsibility, and we'll define that term in a moment, and class equity, okay? And the second part of our project is to account for those changes. So what explains cross-national and cross-policy variation on these issues? And third, which is very important, especially in many developing countries in Latin America, is going beyond policy adoption. What happens with implementations? You know, governments can often pass laws, and then, you know, the buck stops there. We really want to go beyond that. And very little research is done on that and sort of make linkages between policy adoption and what actually happens on the ground and how are these policies implemented. However, right now, we're at the beginning stages of our research project, and so we're completing part one, and that is what our presentation today will focus on. Okay. So, our empirical focus for our project is we look at work-family policies in five what we call best-case scenarios in Latin America, which are Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Costa Rica, and Uruguay. And what we mean by best-case scenarios, they are countries with higher state capacity, and they have legacies of more robust social policies, and they're also in more advanced stages of demographic transition, so the fertility rates have gone down, and they also have, going back to some of the data that Juliana talked about, the most formal labor markets. Okay, so it's a good point of departure to start from, since very little analysis exists on this topic in this kind of a comparative way. Start with the sort of best case scenarios, and then hopefully over time move also the analysis to other Latin American countries. Also, what we look at here is policy adoption at the national level, so not yet implementation. We're still collecting indicators on that. Also, we look at the national level in this country. So for federal countries, we're looking at the national federal level. We're not yet looking at the subnational level. And our focus is here on families with under school-age children. Okay, policies directed towards families with children 5 years and younger. And what we have done is collect data to look at where policies were in 2000 and then 2011 to sort of see the point of departure and then the net change in the last decade or just over a decade. And we do so drawing on an original data set that we've been working on for the past year.
So what we want to know is how these policies being adopted are shaping or reshaping class and class equity and gender relations. Provided that this is such an unequal region, the most unequal region in the world, we think we have to focus at the intersection between these two class and gender dynamics. So in order to assess policies along these two dimensions, to look at class, we are basically interested in learning whether these policies might help overcome socioeconomic stratification. And so, of course, we draw from Sten Andersen's work and his distinction on whether people are eligible to policy based on citizenship, contributions, or needs. But at the same time, because of the prominence of informal labor relations in Latin America, we want to know whether, specifically, whether these policies are reaching beyond the most salary, the most formal salaried workers in the labor market, right? So that's our main criteria. Both citizenship-based and needs-based policies can help do that, right? Help the less formal workers access these policies. And secondly, we want to look at gender relations, and here we focus on two different aspects of it. First, we look at co-responsibility, right? We draw from a rich literature on the European countries that analyzes welfare regimes and how friendly how women friendly and how friendly to gender relations are these regimes. But our unit of analysis are policies rather than regimes. So we adapt some of this literature to look at whether policy is getting involved, seeks to get governments and men involved in care, right? Therefore, redistributing responsibility away or beyond women. So these are policies that will certainly have an effect on the gender gap. They'll reduce the gender gap. They will overall defamiliarize and defeminize care, right? Which is a language or a concept broadly used in the literature on the European countries. Now, there's a second type of policies which we also look at, which we call maternalistic, drawing also on Olof and other authors. These policies do not seek to reduce the gender gap, right? But they create a basic floor they are affirmative action policies to sort of like equalize opportunities for women's participation in the labor market as it regards their responsibilities for unpaid work. So we distinguish between hard maternalism and soft maternalism right here. I mean, maternalist policies are those that then basically acknowledge the importance of care, but conceive of care as women's sole responsibility. So they go through women to reach children. So under these maternalistic policies, we distinguish between hard and soft maternalism. So hard maternalism would be, for instance, extended maternity leave are intended just for women rather than to get men involved in broader defined parental leaves. And soft maternalistic policies would be policies that are apparently gender neutral, such as policies that promote part-time jobs, but that in the end up reinforcing the notion that care is women's responsibility. So we use this combination of criteria to assess the role of policy being adopted. In terms of our conceptual lenses to organize the empirical analysis, we look at three types of policies for the countries Marike was mentioning. depending on whether these policies reallocate income, income support, time, or services. So we draw on Maria Angeles Duran and her distinction between sequential, derivative, and regulatory policy, and make some adaptation to her typology. So basically, sequential policies are those that help alternate time between paid and unpaid work. For example, maternity leave, right? But they can also involve alternating not just weeks, but hours or even days. So different kinds of leave, care leave, and so on, without threatening income security, right? Protecting income security. Secondly, derivative policies, which are policies that shift care provision away from the household and the family and therefore women to public services. So there is a defamiliarization of care involved in these policies as addressed in the European literature and also in previous literature that focuses on Latin America itself. And finally, regulatory policies that set the rules of the game for the care occupations. That means for those involved in providing care. We depart from Nancy Fulbright's notion that care involves a personal connection between those who care and those who are being cared, and therefore the quality of services depends a lot on the quality of jobs that those who provide care have. And we are interested particularly in paid domestic workers since they play a very important role in Latin America. About 15% of the female active population in Latin America works as paid domestic worker. And secondly, this creates a deterrent for collective public services to be set in place, right? Because it contributes to private exit solutions by the middle and the middle upper class. So we look at these three types of policies and basically determine how much change and what type of change has taken place between 2000 and 2011. So we have employment-based leave and cash transfers as two types of sequential policies. None of these policies were designed for reconciling work and family. None of them, right? We are looking at policies that were designed with a different purpose in mind, but all of them play an important role in that tension between work and families. So we look at employment-based leave and cash transfer as sequential policies. We look at cash transfers and care services as indication of derivative policies, and at care occupations as examples of regulatory policies. And the most controversial one has to do with cash transfers, right? Conditional cash transfers in particular that are so important nowadays in Latin America. We make an effort to consider policies that are important for the income security of low-income women. And cash transfers can play a role as sort of like an extension of maternity leave to poor women, and eventually could also play a role as a means to defamiliarize paid care services. And we know this is controversial, and this is something we may want to discuss later on, but it's one of the key policies targeted at poor women in the region, and that's why we consider them as both type of sequential and derivative policies.
Okay. So this next table gets to the heart of how we operationalize these concepts and bring it all together. And what this does is provide examples, maybe I'll come to this side, provides examples of how we classify policies, both in terms of whether they're sequential, derivative, or regulatory, and then how they go in terms of how the policy alters social equity. Okay? And so I'll just walk you through this table briefly. If you look there, for example, with sequential policies, and this is how we categorize policies. I'll give you examples. a maternalist sequential social policy would be extended maternity leave. So going beyond the sort of basic World Health Organization ILO minimum, which, you know, a woman needs a certain number of months, like 3 months, let's say 4 months. Beyond that, leaves that are restricted to mothers, we would classify as maternalist, okay? Leaves that allow either parent, so parental leave that would allow either parent to pick up that part of the leave, or leaves that are specifically only for fathers, we would classify as policies that promote co-responsibility, okay? Then these in the upper half of the quadrant, these would be policies that are formal employment based. Okay, so for people employed with permanent contracts in the formal sector, then we look at whether these policies extend beyond formal sector workers. Okay, and so in that sense, especially in a region like Latin America, whether they promote class equity. Okay, and so extended maternity leaves for mothers beyond most formal workers would be maternalist with class equity. And then ones that are parental or paternity leaves for beyond most formal workers would promote both co-responsibility as well as class equity, okay? And then the next column is derivative policies. And there's a bit of an overlap here because derivative policies, as Juliana described, is by definition promotes co-responsibility because it's taking, you know, the state taking over some of the responsibilities for caregiving from families, right? So derivative policies by definition are in general promote co-responsibility. Within that, there might be other elements going on, right? Because there can be different sub-elements to each policy. And there we would classify, for example, employer-based care services that are specifically restricted to working mothers as maternalist. And so in some countries you'll have employer mandates where firms with over 20 female employees must provide certain daycare services for those women when they have children under a certain age, okay? And their goal tends to often be to allow women to continue nursing their babies while they're at work rather than really provide a comprehensive long-term care solution, okay? And so they might be restricted for example, for the first 6 months or for the first year of the child's life, okay? If such employer-based services are based on working parents overall, so they can be extended to fathers or mothers, then we would consider them policies that promote co-responsibility. Then policies that come from the public sector and are provided, the eligibility criteria is need or citizenship, those would be policies that promote class equity, okay? And if such policies are restricted, for example, to low-income working mothers, then we would classify them as maternalist. However, if you have the provision of childcare services based on need or citizenship, then we would classify such policies as promoting both co-responsibility and class equity. Okay? And then finally here we have regulatory policies, and I'll give a couple of examples of that. For example, if government policies seek to provide support for informal care provider networks. I'll give you an example. For example, in Mexico, they provide certain subsidies for mothers who sort of bring more children to their own home and sort of provide informal daycare for other working mothers in the neighborhood. And that's based on the role of the mother, sort of extending that role of the mother to more children. They tend to be ones, they do not tend to provide pension, social security benefits. Then we would classify such policies as maternalist. Policies that try to provide really equal rights and equal treatment to workers in care occupations, we would classify as promoting both co-responsibility and class equity, with the state taking more of a responsibility for providing that. And here, for example, providing equal rights for domestic workers would be an indicator of a policy of promoting co-responsibility and class equity. Like Juliana said, domestic workers, altogether about 30% of households in Latin America are tied to this occupation, either as employers of domestic workers or households that actually provide domestic workers. And you have a long history of legal discrimination against that, and so that would be an example of providing both of those.
So, empirical findings. What has changed in the region concerning these four types of policy since 2000? What has changed and in what direction? So we'll walk you through findings per policy dimension and then wrap up with our overall assessment of what's changed. So let's look at first at leave, employment-based leave, and how it's helping or not class equity. So here, what we do is we measure who is entitled to access employment-based leave. And we distinguish between it's some salaried workers. So for example, it's all salaried workers but domestic workers, or it's all salaried workers but those who do not have formal contracts. We look at when it's all salaried workers that are reached by this leave. And finally, whether it's own account temporary workers. So the ideal situation is one in which people have access to employment-based leave, regardless of whether they are salaried or non-salaried, right? So what you can see in the graph, I mean, is that you see change in two countries, in Chile and in Costa Rica, in between 2000 and 2011. In the other countries, there was no change. So in Chile, here, between 2000 and 2011, policy first reached all salaried workers and later reached also self-account workers, right? And in the case of Costa Rica, a pension reform also involved reaching the self-employed. We don't see change in Brazil, which already had them incorporated in 2000, and we don't see changes in Argentina or Uruguay, where self-account workers were not included in 2000. And moreover, in Argentina, it's some salaried workers, not all salaried workers, and there's been no change, which is quite intriguing, because domestic workers are not included. So so this gives you an overall sense of changes that would that have or should be having a positive effect on class equity as it concerns employment-based leave. Now, what's happening with gender relations? And here you see that most of what's happening is amazingly maternalistic, right? So we constructed this graph following Ray and others and using weeks as a unit of measurement to compare countries and to distinguish between maternity leave, that is leave restricted to mothers, paternity leave restricted to fathers, and shared leave, which can be either parent can take the leave. And as you can see, most of what you see, if you can see it, is red, which is maternity leave, right?
It's now, very dark. You can see the little blues.
That's the very little. I'll get to that. So in 2000, this maternity leave ranged from 12 weeks in Uruguay to 18 weeks in Chile. So Chile had a long maternity leave already in 2000. And paternity leaves, as Marike is saying, in the dark areas, ranged from 0 days in Costa Rica and Uruguay to 1 day in Chile to 2 days in Argentina since 1974, which is interesting, and to 5 days in Brazil, right, since the 1988 constitution. So that's the range between 0 and 5 in 2000. So most change, as you can see, takes place in Chile between 2000 and 2011. Most change takes place there. I should have said that all of this leave involved 100% compensation, in some cases with caps. And the white over there for Argentina is unpaid leave. So most change takes place in Chile. And what's interesting is that on the one hand, Chile extended the maternity leave from 18 weeks to 7.5 months for women. So that's a highly maternalistic move. But on the other hand, it created a leave of 3 months that can be shared by women and men. So in that sense, we see an attempt at promoting co-responsibility between women and men. It's optional. And then the paternity leave itself was also extended from one day to 5 days, which is like a 500% increase, right? I mean, so. So we look at other things like who pays for this leave, which is usually the social security insurance, except in Chile where it's government, and except in Costa Rica where it's half government, half social insurance, half the employer. So overall, as you can see, there is not much change, and the change you see, particularly in Chile, shows the combination of maternalism and co-responsibility. So the second policy dimension has to do with cash transfers. So these cash transfers that can reach women that are not part of the formal labor force.
Oh, and by the way, I forgot to perhaps mention it in that conceptual table where we operationalize stuff, where we would classify that would be under sequential policies that are maternalist and promote class equity. And you can maybe talk a little bit more about why, but I forgot to mention that when we went through the table.
Yeah, well, these programs target children under 6 years of age, which is our target population, but also target pregnant women. And in that sense, they play the role of a maternity leave for those who are who have a formal paid work.
They provide minimal income security for mothers or parents with very small children, like during pregnancy and then the years following pregnancy, and so that's why we classify them like that. Since they tend to target mothers, and or these cash transfers go to mothers, and for instrumental reasons, because you know, in order to reach the children, that's why we classify them as maternal.
Now, these are soft maternalistic policies because in the absence of the mother, somebody else can pick up the cash transfer, right? So you can see that this is all red, right? And we classify policy in terms of whether there is no national program, as it's the case in Costa Rica for children this age, whether there is a national program but with a very narrow eligibility criteria in terms of means testing and the measurement, and on whether there is a broad criteria. So all countries except Costa Rica either established or expanded national cash transfers programs based on a broad criteria of eligibility. So so in Argentina, for example, the Asignación Universal por Hijo has a set of criteria that basically makes the program reach a broad set of the population. In Chile, it can reach up to 60% of the income population, lower income population. It doesn't mean it reaches the 60% of the population, but you can be within that range of income. In Uruguay, half of the population, so they usually have a very broad criteria. And except, as I said before, in Costa Rica. They are very diverse in terms of their generosity. So Argentina, in Argentina, the Asignación Universal por Hijo grants $68 per month per child, whereas in Brazil and Chile it's between $20 and $30 per month per child, and in Uruguay it's $35. Uruguay's program is not enshrined by law, so the stability of the program could be higher than in the other countries in which these transfers are statutory.
Statutory.
Yeah, I have a problem with that word. I think I never be able to. Well, but yes.
Okay. So the next policy dimension is daycare services, and in a way it's the most complicated to operationalize systematically and comparatively. And so this is our shot at it. If you have feedback, we'd love to hear it. Let me first say that this looks at, again, policy adoption. And so what we try to, we have two graphs on it. And so this first one looks at national policies on care services, children 0 to 3 years of age, okay? We also have data that we've collected on preschool, which is often considered above 3 years, and under six is usually considered preschool. We haven't yet made it into graphs, so here we're going to focus on 0 to 3 year olds that often tend to be the crucial sort of age group. And we have two tables. This is the policies, and then we have one on eligibility criteria. And like we said, this promotes co-responsibility and class equity. Okay? So here what we're trying to do is tap into the seriousness of government commitment on this issue. Okay? And again, this is on public policies on care services. And just as a brief background, I mentioned earlier some employer mandates. Empirically, three of our countries, Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, do have employer mandates based on the number of working women in large firms that need to provide, at least theoretically, again, and implementation is another issue, but need to theoretically provide some level of daycare services for very, very young children. Those are all policy legacies. They were instituted before 2000. And we see no movement on those issues in the last 10 years. Where we see the movement is on public care services towards this age group. So this is how we've operationalized it. These colors are actually not the best, but I hope you can see them here. The first line is existence of a national program. And so if you have a national program in existence, we give the country 1 point. If the program has explicit eligibility criteria, so for example, it specifies that all poor and socially vulnerable parents should have access to these services, then we give it another point, okay, because it again taps into the seriousness of the government commitment. If the program has actual coverage targets with some sort of a time frame, it gets yet another point, a sort of turquoise one there, they're clearly sort of more committed to it. And then finally, whether actually data on coverage for 2000, the year 2000s exists, they get another point for that. Because obviously, if they're really serious about this, they also have to collect data on it. And in some countries, you don't have data on it, and that also gives you an indication of how much priority the government puts into it. So actually, the last, between 3 and 4 points, that could be really in the middle, right? Because that's data for the 2000s. And so think of it perhaps as extending to both of them. We have to still work on how to best present it on the graph. So this is what that is measuring. And so empirically, now if you look at the changes across these countries, you see that by 2010, all countries had something. So this is an area where we have seen movements in the last 10 years. Okay, the weakest ones were in Argentina and Costa Rica. And Argentina went from nothing to 1 point because it created a framework law in the year 2007 that was basically an attempt to regulate public daycare services. But no explicit eligibility criteria, coverage targets are in the law or the regulatory degree, so we only give it a 1, okay? Costa Rica has a small national program from the 1970s, but there's really been no change there, and it also doesn't meet these other criteria. With Brazil and Uruguay, we see the most well-developed national policies on this issue already in the year 2000. Okay. For example, in Brazil, the right to daycare or early childhood education and care is enshrined in the Brazilian constitution from 4 months on until school age. And in the 1990s, it was actually transferred into a law. And Brazil does have explicit eligibility criteria, which is pretty easy. It's universal. But it also has coverage targets, okay? And so, for example, in 2000, the National Action Plan of the Ministry of Education said that our coverage target is that in the next 5 years, 50% of children will have this access. 10 years later, they had explicit coverage target again, which was 50% of the population in the next 10 years. So, again, this does not measure implementation. That's our next step, right? I mean, implementation might be a completely different story, but this shows government commitment, so to speak, okay? And then in Chile, we see a real change again. From a restrictive program that was established in the 1990s without clear coverage targets to Chile Crece Contigo, which was established under Bachelet, that has really, you know, is targeted at the lowest 60% of the population and does have coverage targets and data for that exists. And here, very briefly, I already kind of went through this, but this sort of measures the eligibility criteria, and we're trying to systematically make this systematic and comparative, okay? So we can compare how countries are doing against each other. And here we have 0 is no eligibility criteria. One is restrictive criteria, two is broad, and then three is universal. And so this gives you some idea of the kinds of eligibility criteria we have across countries. And so Brazil does the best in the sense that it's universal, if the goal is to have as many as possible. And then Chile and Uruguay are second best, and then the others come after that. Okay, our final policy dimension and final table has to do with policies towards domestic workers, so also policies that promote both co-responsibility and class equity. And this graph measures the equalization of domestic workers' rights in our five countries in labor codes in the last 10 years. And as we already mentioned, historically, we have discrimination, legal discrimination against this working, this occupation, in work hours, in benefits, in minimum wage, in all sorts of different areas. Okay, and that's explicit legal discrimination. Often they have working hours that might extend to 72 to 96 hours a week, when other workers' work week is 40 to 48 hours a week. And so you have clear differences. And what we do here is we, in different policy dimensions, we see if rights have been equalized. Okay, and so this gives you an idea. And again, you don't really see the colors here. I don't know if it's the lighting or what. So I apologize for that. But I'll summarize it briefly. So this shows whether rights have been equalized. If you get a six points, it means that their rights have been completely equalized. Okay, and then you have other areas like equal work hours, equal vacations, national minimum wage is equivalent for this group, whether they also have access to Social Security, whether they also have maternity leave, and then what we call no other explicit discrimination, because some countries have different sort of more idiosyncratic discriminations, and so we lump all of that in there. Okay? And so what this shows is that we've seen a lot of movement in the last 10 years on the issue, and both Uruguay and Costa Rica have actually equalized domestic worker rights. So remaining illegal discrimination does not exist. In the other countries, none of the other countries have equalized the work hours, because that tends to be the most contentious issue, because it really gets to the heart of the relationship. But we do see movement sort of in piecemeal reforms in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Chile on different areas. Okay, and here again, Argentina is the most behind. Just as a context, which I'm sure you know, this is a highly dynamic area because last year the ILO passed a convention on domestic workers' rights. And that has had an impact in Latin America, and you can really see that influence of the international convention. And in fact, in Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, the executive has proposed bills to equalize remaining discrimination. Okay. However, in both Brazil and Argentina, those bills are stalled in the Senate, so we don't know what will happen, but there's clearly an impetus for more change. Okay, to conclusions. Very briefly, and Juliana will pick up from this, as an overall sort of to pick out some overall trends, what we see over the last 10 decades in these countries is that most of the policy reforms of the past decade have revolved around cash transfers, domestic worker rights, and care services. All three types have promoted class equity. So we see more of an effort of governments in Latin America to promote class equity, okay, in the last 10 years. The services, especially, you can see say that they give the most bang for the buck because they also promote gender equity through co-responsibility, okay? We don't see much change towards promoting paternal co-responsibility. If you remember, the maternity leave, parental leave remains overwhelmingly maternalist. And that's in distinction to the movement, especially in the European Union, where we see much more emphasis on promoting co-responsibility in parental leave.
So if we look at this from the point of view of a cross-national perspective, we see that Brazil had relatively most advanced policies in 2000, particularly, again, at the policy adoption stage, and little change since then. Chile is the country that strikes as having the most policy change between 2000 and 2011 across policy dimensions. Quite to the opposite, in Argentina started off the period as a laggard, if you will, and remains as such. And we don't see much change in Argentina, which is puzzling. And Uruguay and Costa Rica fall in the middle, except in domestic workers, because they are the only two countries that, as Marika explained, equalized legal rights for domestic workers. So wrapping up the contribution we are trying to make with this, you know, we seek to have a framework that's suitable for cross-national and cross-policy analysis. Well, we always say that this is an area in which we can easily get into this half-full, half-empty glass. So we really need criteria that's kind of explicit, can be improved, but it's also explicit and transparent to look at cross-national and cross-policy, across policies. We are proposing a classification of policy dimensions that help us get an overall picture of what's going on with work-family relations beyond the specific policy dimensions. So it's important to learn about each of these policy dimensions, but then they are all part of a larger puzzle in which that may improve or deter more class and gender equity or more co-responsibility and class equity. We are hoping to have come up with a systematic method to organize and analyze qualitative data. I mean, behind this, there is an amazing amount of hours, you know, our own work and research assistance, because none of this is, except for leave, you cannot find a database that will tell you what's going on, unlike for the European countries in which you press the button and then you have these wonderful statistical databases. So a lot of the work involved has to do with organizing and analyzing bills, legal executive policies, and so on and so forth. And we are putting together this original data set, not only based on the legal documents, but also newspapers. We have like a decade of newspapers, a very diverse set of newspapers for all five countries, which will be, for example, very useful to analyze issue framing in the next stage. So we've been doing a combination of conceptual and inductive work, which we presented, and well, most of the most interesting stuff comes next, right? I mean, why is change happening here and not there? I mean, is it female executives? Is it left-wing parties? Is it, what is it, right? But we figured that we cannot do that unless we have a clear sense of our dependent variable, you know, whether change has happened or not. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for a really lively, rich, and interesting presentation. I'd like to open the floor, since we said we're going to finish by about 1:45. I think it would be nice to have some questions and some discussion around the presentation. So, please.
But it's about something you said at the beginning of the presentation. And it's just something I'm interested in. And I was wondering, you mentioned that, you know, all of the countries were in the process of democratic transition. And with that came...
Demographic.
Demographic. Okay, because I was like...
Demographic.
Yeah, okay, I misunderstood my question.
Yeah, I know the transitions were 20 years ago.
Right.
Yes.
Well, except for Honduras, Nicaragua,
okay,
Venezuela,
that's good.
You know.
Yeah, depending on...
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amadi. It has been interesting. My question is about the way to measure the kind of... co-responsibility and equity, especially for domestic workers.
Uh-huh.
I think the always I found problem in aggregated index, yeah, or composite index. I mean, you place the same weight on the different dimensions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for instance, only you put the same score like for minimum wage,
yeah,
and for equal work hours.
Yeah.
Right? But I think in your conclusion that Brazil was relatively well developed in 2000, with little change. But there was a big change in terms of minimum wage. And that, I think they explained their success in social development in terms of establishing minimum wage for all workers. And I think the policymakers emphasized the importance of minimum wage implementation in all dimensions of social policy. And in that case, I mean, is there any way to kind of highlight the weight of importance of minimum wage compared to other dimensions of your index?
Right.
So, because, I mean, in your case countries, I mean, you can see the difference between those countries, but if you increase the sample,
yeah,
of case studies, I think some countries have equal hours, but doesn't have
the minimum wage,
but some countries have minimum wage without equal working hours.
Yeah.
But minimum wage is much more important than, I think, equal hours, because sometimes minimum wage is a kind of driver for improvement in other dimensions of labor market or social development. So I just kind of provocative question about that.
Right, right. Right.
We'll do it around and then we'll come back.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, Sarah?
Yeah, but I mean, it's quite related, but I was trying to think, where you finished was on, you know, teasing out this comparative framework. And I think one of the things that kept standing out for me was Costa Rica. And on the one hand, there's a sort of implicit sense, I guess, that when you have these indices, you know, a higher number is good. And then you have to, you know, the question of why, you know, on the cash transfers, it obviously is zero. So then what are the other factors, and how much do you bring into your comparative analysis? Is it that, you know, and maybe this is the economic material that needs to somehow be incorporated, is it that there is a more formal labor market and therefore there's less poverty and there's less need for cash transfers that support this population? Is it that there's...
Sorry, economic, the factors, now you're talking about potential explanatory factors or factors that should be part of the dependent variable.
Well, I think that's where the issue comes in making the comparative framework, and I think it does relate to, if you've got these indices, I can see that's what I've been teasing out as I've been listening to you. You're trying to get the policy change.
Right.
But where the starting point of that policy is matters for the change.
Yes.
And where that starting point is incorporates some of these things. So they're sort of endogenous.
Exactly.
It's a puzzle rather than saying it's a problem, but it's something to think about. That's
interesting. Can I just add also one thing which kind of comes on exactly what the points that Lil Chung and Sarah have made, which was this thing on services you had, that if they are particularly targeted to low-income households, they get another score. Mm. I mean, doesn't that, and it's a question about the meaning of your indicators. I mean, to me, that also could be read as creating more segmented forms of service provision. And how do we capture the, for example, I would have thought that maybe it's okay to have that as long as we also have an indicator that captures the quality or per child expenditure in these services that are targeted to low income, so that we don't end up valuing something that's actually providing cheaper services for low income. Do you get my argument?
Totally.
Okay, so I think it's part of the same problematic that
I'm
trying to raise here. Yes, Shubham.
Yeah. So I was late, sorry, I made something really important in the beginning. As I mentioned, I think we're also trying to identify maybe the impact of the change of those policies, especially when you compare across countries.
You mean implementation? You mean like implementation?
Eventually what will be out, the impact, because you are doing cross-country analysis and every country is, I know you identify different dimensions, try to make them comparable. So you also talk about the independent variables. I'm wondering what are the common outcome variables you are thinking about to evaluate the impact of all those policies, whether it will be inequality issues, or you are looking at the consumption patterns of the families when they got all this support, or perhaps the outcome of the children. And I'm wondering, what are you thinking of the next study?
Okay, that's...
Can I start?
Do you want to respond to this round, and then we can have another round of questions?
Right.
Okay.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
The first reaction is it's our understanding that the more universal, the better, right? So we value more broad targeting than narrow targeting, right? So in that sense, because we think that the more universal will be better to, you know, bring different income groups on board. We are not getting at quality, because it's very difficult to assess that for adoption, right? But we'll have to do it when we assess implementation, right? Now, how to measure the net gain between 2000 and 2011? This is our third take at it, and we've tried different things. And the more we've tried it, the more we've simplified the measurement so that it's more transparent and straightforward. we used to have a much more complicated indexes that look at each policy and break it down into different dimensions. And and so we've tried to draw on the literature wherever the literature has something strong to offer, for example, WICs. Right, but if the literature has to offer, you know, measure coverage by the implementation stage, then A, we don't have that data yet, and B, it's not adoption but implementation. So we, and in that case, we try to come up with an alternative way of measuring that's reasonable and doable at the same time, and that's why we've stayed away from weighting the relative dimension, you know, like for example, income versus minimum income versus equal wages. You know, we've done it the most simple way we can do it, and our understanding is that all of those dimensions are important. And as Merike was saying, well, and she knows this subject much better than I do. The most controversial one has to do with working hours, because everyone can get away. I mean, can get away from the minimum wage, you know. But the working hours sort of like moves away from the notion that domestic workers are basically servants, you know, kind of like half workers, half slaves, you know, always sort of like serving the needs of the employer, you know, and never being considered as a worker with rights and so on and so forth. Now, in terms of Costa Rica, but overall, not only for Costa Rica, what we tried doing, we tried to have 2000 as the point of departure that also has the legacy in that sense, right? So if by 2000 a country was doing really well, then we should have it, it should show in 2000, right? And so
2000, in, okay.
In 2000, and then we can show whether there's a change between 2000 and 2011. I think you are totally right about the control variables. You know, we are not showing those control factors, and I guess we should, you know. Poverty is much higher in Costa Rica than in any of the other countries that, well, the southern cone particularly, higher in Brazil. So that's not the key explanation. It seems to be more related to policy priorities. Costa Rica has all sorts of in-kind stuff for children, and cash transfers go to children in high school rather than in primary school, where the high dropout rates are. And that's why it doesn't show, you know, as coming strong on this particular policy. But our idea, and please, you know, feel free to jump in, is that 2000 should show the legacy, and then we move on to the net gain obtained during the decade that comes after.
Yeah. A couple of additional points to what Juliana said. Yeah, the issue is when we measure the services, our categories are sort of restrictive, broad, and universal, right? So we don't give more weight. So the most weight we give or the highest points are for universal policies, then broad ones, and then restrictive. And so if they're really narrowly targeted to low-income populations, then they, like, get 1 point, right, versus two versus three. So we try and sort of measure that. And in terms of the... But there might be something that, you know, we need to think more about. I mean, these were very ambiguous categories because, again, we were trying to figure out categories that would make this comparable across these countries. And in terms of the quality of services, that's really important. And there's very little data. I was trying to look into just expenditure levels, right, for daycare services. And some of that, like, it does not seem to exist comparatively. And for the OECD countries, it's great, or the EU, you just click a button and you get it. That data doesn't even exist for Latin American countries, which also shows the lack of priority the government is giving to this issue, right? So we're going to have to come up with innovative ways to tap into that without having sort of really direct proxies, right? Maybe there's a way to collect it, but it's going to require some effort and some kind of funding. And in terms of, I totally second what Juliana said about the domestic workers. Here's the thing. We try to make the indices as transparent as possible. Because, like, your point is good, but it's not everybody would agree with it. Because the truth is that for domestic workers, the most controversial issue in Latin American countries, I don't know about the rest of the world, is work hours. Okay, minimum wage passage has not been that difficult because in many cases they've already earned the minimum wage. wage. And so, for example, in Chile, granting them the legal minimum wage was symbolic. And I, you know, the government officials even said this is an easy reform. Nobody opposes it because their market wage is already higher. So it really depends. But the work hours is what really gets to the heart of the relationship. So I'm not sure that I would necessarily wait. I mean, you could make a good argument. We could have a really interesting debate. But I'm not sure that I would necessarily wait. Minimum wage is more important. So that way, in that sense, I think it's better just to keep them one-on-one, be transparent about it, and then people can always read it the way they want to. And as long as they know how it's been coded, then they can sort of, you know, draw their own sort of analysis from it. And then the final point, which about the common outcome variables, yeah, at the beginning of our presentation, we said that the third part of our project is to look at implementation. We haven't gotten to that yet. Yeah, we had a really interesting debate about this even yesterday, right? It's like, how do you measure implementation? And I think that we'll probably look not at outcome variables that you mentioned because they sort of go too far. We'll look more directly at policy implementation because once you get to outcomes, all sorts of other confounding factors come in, like an economic crisis or blah, 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 whatever, you know, and so then you can't really tease out the direct policy impact. So what we might look at, for example, with leaves is try to figure out take-up rates by the number of, like, people who take maternity leave versus the number of children and born that year, like to get rough proxies of just the number of people that are taking maternity leave, you know, and with daycare services, the coverage rate is like the obvious one. So that I think we're going more in the direction of like more immediate implementation variables.
Mm-hmm. Very helpful, yes.
And just to build on the last point you said, I think it would be extremely interesting to see the take-up rates on paternity or shared leave in terms of the co-responsibility. Like that might, you know, that might show something surprising that we wouldn't expect for Latin America.
Well, no, so far, unfortunately, in Chile, when they introduced this joint where you can split it between the mother and the father, and that policy only went into effect in November 2011. In the first month, tens of thousands of women took the maternity leave part. Random guess how many fathers took the parental leave part? 16. Like that's 16%.
16
men.
No, but your point is well taken, and yes, we have to work on that database.
We
and
need we, to.
Yeah, exactly. We don't think it's going to be that hard if you know, we get social insurance.
Any other questions? Can I just add maybe a question on? I know you're not there yet, but you must have some hypotheses. Once you've got your dependent variable all sorted out, but you must already have some hypotheses as to what factors explain the most significant policy changes that, you know, we've seen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are your, just as a way of wrapping up, if you have any kind of hypotheses in terms of what are the variables that, in your opinion, explain?
Yeah.
Can I say what we think are not, and then you can say what...
Okay.
I mean, they are not some of the most well-established factors in the literature on European countries and all, such as unionization. You know, unionization in Chile is so low, and in Costa Rica is less than 5%, you know, when you consider the private sector. In Uruguay, on the other hand, it's very high, and it doesn't strike you as being having a lot to show, right? The second factor, you know, the relative... role of women in the labor force is also another factor that should be, you know, pushing for change. And Uruguay has the highest percentage of women in the labor force, and it is as if you know, policymakers were saying, you know, I'm originally from Uruguay, by the way, so I feel entitled to criticize. You know, it's as if the government was saying, well, they are already in the labor market, you know, and they don't seem
why
to
bother?
Care, so you know, why bother? So those two factors are clearly not, you know, structural factors that are playing such a big role. But we are looking at young children, families with young children. Perhaps if you look at families with elderly population, it's a different ballgame, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's emerging is, again, as a sort of guesstimates, is that the role of, you know, international issue networks combined with policy technocrats and especially femocrats. So top-down stuff seems to be playing an important role in these countries, rather than with some policies bottom-up, like care services, you know, was, you know, women in the labor force organized into labor unions that were very important, like European countries. But here we don't see that. And labor unions can sometimes even work against some of these policies. And so I think that's going to be an important part is these international issue networks, international influences, and well-placed femocrats in women's ministries who sort of show leadership on these issues.
And also because what we do get the sense that unionization in countries like Uruguay, collective bargaining is given workers already, you know, even paternity leaves that are longer than for workers that are not under collective bargaining. So in a sense, the incentive is not there, you know, to spend so much political capital in something that these very organized workers already have. So there is sort of like an insider-outsider dilemma.
Okay. I think that's a really interesting question, if I can just add, because I've just been reading this paper by Mala Hatun and Laurie Weldon, who do very similar type of cross-country comparison. Theirs is on violence against women, and they measure a lot of the ways in which, you know, there's been policy change. And then they search for explanatory variables. And that analysis on violence against women comes out to say that what's really been making this happen is not only the existence of women's movements, but autonomous feminist movements and organizations. So it's really been kind of a bottom-up. Of course, there's been transnational influences, maybe, in how they've framed the issues and how, you know. But it hasn't been the classic explanation of, you know, left parties or, you know, the structural explanation. So there may be a difference across different kinds of issues. So, you know, violence against women, feminist organizations and women's movements, maybe here it's more top-down technocratic. So.
And timing, because, like, with the violence against women, I think initially autonomous movements played a really important role, but now that it's become an international sort of issue, it's more top-down. And like you see with domestic workers, it was initially much more bottom-up, but now that the ILO convention has passed, it's becoming more top-down, and so...
Yeah, and the nature of the policies we are looking at, because of the inequality that pervades Latin America, and because these are redistributive policies, they are very much cut across class lines, right? So employment-based leave is more important for middle-class women, whereas services, CCTs, and domestic regulations for domestic workers is more important for lower-income women.
Right.
And we don't see much cross-class coalition going on. There's not much of a public good after which women are after, which is kind of... sad, but that's why we bring the domestic workers component, because we think it creates a deterrent for middle-class women to actually pursue services, right? I mean, because they have their service at home in this kind of like commodified but very informal way of commodification that's very cheap, you know, very convenient, very cheap, very low cost.
Okay, I think on behalf of Unraised, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to make this interesting presentation, and we wish you all the best for the rest of the study, and we look forward to seeing the findings of the three stages and, you know, the entire study and publication.
Thank you very much.
Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.